I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Welcome to Fronteras, a show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. The number of cancer cases among Latinos increased by 72% between 2000 and 2014. Those cancer cases are expected to rise another 142% by 2030. What's being done to raise awareness among Latinos about cancer prevention and cancer screenings? A recent conference in San Antonio brought together researchers and leaders to discuss how to improve awareness through science, treatment, and policy. Dr. Amelie Ramirez is a professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at UT Health San Antonio. She's also the director for cancer prevention and population science at the institution's Mays Cancer Center. Ramirez says health and economic disparities place this population at risk.
Well, one of the most critical risks that we're seeing is the lack of health insurance, in particular here in Texas. You know, we have some of the lowest rates of insured Latinos, and this prevents them from participating in more preventive care. And preventive care is so critical for our population, because I can still go out and do focus groups in our communities to talk about cancer, and people don't want to talk about it. They really and truly fear the word cancer, that just talking about it might make them more susceptible to getting cancer. But the biggest thing that we can do to prevent it is to come in early and to be screened on a regular basis, and to educating our community about how often they should come in for different types of screening, whether it's breast, cervical, or colon screening, for example.
Are there any biological markers that might be unique among the Latino population that might make them more susceptible to cancer? We hear about diabetes, that the Hispanic population is more susceptible to diabetes than the white population. But what is it about the Latino population that might make them more susceptible to a cancer?
One of the issues that might make them more susceptible is obesity. We don't have necessarily a biological marker for that, but we're seeing that, for example, in liver cancer, that a large portion of our population have fatty livers, and that fatty liver over a long period of time becomes cancerous. And so these are some of the things that we're beginning to study more. We have cancers that we called understudied. We haven't studied enough about them. Some of the ones that are more prevalent in our communities are liver cancer, and that's rising for everybody. We don't know if it's the hepatitis relation, but in our communities, in our Latino communities, we're seeing more of a relationship to diabetes and obesity that are strong correlations with liver cancer and alcohol consumption. The other is stomach cancer. You know, the H. pylori, it's a virus that we get from eating foods that perhaps aren't as clean as they should be, that might have a bacteria, and it kind of develops. There are vaccinations for that or antibiotics, but you don't know you have it. So some of our illnesses are not symptomatic at an early stage. So there's more research that we need to do there. Gallbladder cancer is another one that we need to learn more about, and why is it higher in our community. And then the other one is kidney cancer. So a lot of these are organs that, you know, are kind of dietary related. Many of these organs are our filtration system. So we need to do a lot more research. And the reason we don't have good biological data right now is that Latinos are underrepresented in what we call clinical trials. When a new drug is being developed for the first time, they recruit and they find out if people can participate in these trials to find, is that drug more effective than the current and approved treatment services that we have right now. But our population, less than 5% participate in these clinical trials. So when those medications are now developed and are made available, we don't know if they're working as effectively in our community, because we haven't participated in some of those trials.
And it wasn't that long ago that it was determined that women and men are different, for example, when it comes to heart disease, that a heart attack for women is going to be different than a heart attack for men. So it's interesting how this is all developing, and it's all sort of starting to narrow down to different types of populations.
It is. And one of the things that's really unique about the Latino population, we're not all the same. You know, we have different ancestry origins that contribute to our Latino makeup, right? So some of them may have a little more Native American in us. Some of us may have a little bit more European. Others may have a little bit more African American descent. So all of these things, you know, we're now looking at ancestry markers to see the complexity within the Latino population. It's really important that as much as possible, you know, that we participate in some of these studies. There was a big study. They wanted to recruit 1 million people of all diverse backgrounds, you know, to begin looking at some of these different genetic markers.
Well, I brought up the disparity between women and men when it came to medical research, but you had mentioned something before our conversation here that there is less information known about cancer in Latino males than in females. Why is that?
Well, it's funny. Those of us who are married know how hard it is to get our husbands, right, to go in for any kind of checkup. And the machismo, we tend to call it, is really prevalent out there. You know, they don't necessarily come to some of the educational sessions. You know, women will come and try to learn as much as they can to help their families. But it's really difficult, and this resistance of I'm going to be okay and not wanting to go see a physician is really critical. But I tell them, I said, the macho male needs to stand up and really go in and get those checkups if you want to be here for your family. You know, the sooner we can diagnose cancer, the more treatment options we have available and the more likely you are to survive it.
And I think this is the case not just with Latinos, but with many other minority populations, that there is that cultural thing where the female head of the household, she wants to make sure everybody else in her family is taken care of, even though she might be in pain, she might be suffering, because it's her family that comes first. And when she has some time, maybe she'll take care of herself. What information do you have to sort of break through that barrier to let these people know that you have to take care of yourself before you can take care of others?
Yeah, no, excellent point. You know, there's no reason to say if you feel a lump or something that's different on your breast to not take any time to come in and be screened and diagnosed, you know, if it is breast cancer or not. And so we really need to tell moms, you have to take care of yourself first so that you can take care of the rest of your family. Again, without you, the family is lost. And so we really try to help women to prioritize, you know, themselves to come in for health care. For example, cervical cancer. No women should be dying from cervical cancer anymore. This is the one cancer that we can prevent, detect, and treat early. But again, that's a very private area. People don't want to talk about it. The exam is kind of invasive. I do tease. I wish we could come up with better exams that are not so invasive for women. But this is what we have right now. But at least we have these treatments available. Women need to come in and get checked and make sure that this is not something they die from.
There has to be a way to perhaps help them overcome the shame that they might encounter in some of those exams like you were talking about. Are there any efforts from promotoras or from the medical community who really just try to say, hey, this is how it is. There's no shame involved. It's just between you and your doctor.
Yeah. Well, actually, there is. There was a really great video that was presented at our conference from California in which, you know, they're all getting together to make tamales, and it's also Thanksgiving, and they're talking about going in for a pap smear, and there's a young lady that's of age now to go for a pap smear, and then there's the grandmother who hasn't had her check in a long time, and then the mother. So it was a very great little novella type scenario, and then they were using the turkey as, let me show you how you can do the exam, it doesn't hurt, you know, this is why you should go in, and using a tamale as the tool to go in and get scraped, and they did a great job, and it's getting some really good reviews.
And the thing about cervical cancer, like you were saying, it's one of those cancers that doesn't even need to exist anymore, as it can be easily detected and easily taken care of. But cancer is not one of those words that people really like to talk about, especially in the minority populations. You think by talking about it, you're going to get it. And people probably like talking about cancer probably as much as they like talking about dying when it comes right to Latino households. Mm-hmm. So how do you encourage people to not wait when you even detect what you might think might be the slightest anomaly in your body to go see a doctor?
Well, you know, Norma, the best kept secret is that we can reduce cancer nationwide by 50% by doing some very basic things. Number one, exercising, getting 30 minutes of exercise in a day, eating a healthier diet. We really need to start eating more fresh fruits and vegetables and fresh meats and so forth, and stay away from the processed meats. You know that they're finding a higher link between processed foods and colon cancer. Not smoke. In Latinos, our rates of tobacco use are lower, but we still smoke on a social bases. And so, you know, just giving that out, because the synergy between tobacco and alcohol, head and neck cancers can develop. Coming in for your regular screening are really critical. And so these are fairly simple behaviors that don't take a lot of time out of your day, but that we need to do, and we need to do as a family. We need to encourage our families to get out there and exercise with their kids and eat more at home. We're not eating at home anymore. We're doing a lot of the drive-thrus and many of the saturated fats that they have and some of those foods, but the ingredients and the processed ingredients that they use are not good for us.
Yeah, it's not new news, right? This is something we hear all the time. But I guess people want to hear about that magic pill. But for people who might feel insecure about going to the doctor because they think it's going to run very pricey, there are low-cost clinics for people who might not have insurance. And for people who do have insurance, they might not be aware that screenings like colonoscopies are essentially at no cost when you have insurance. And then there are mobile vans for mammographies. There are many ways that the medical community is reaching out to people who might not be aware that they need help.
No, we really are trying to do a better job of that. And we have an organization called the Cancer Prevention Research Institute of Texas, CPRIT, that has funded, you know, statewide some opportunities to do preventive services. If the person has never been screened before and there's monies in that particular community, not all communities have access to these resources, that they can arrange to get a free screening. Obviously, that if something is diagnosed, that's the more critical problem in how to help get some of our safety net organizations to pay for any follow-up treatment. But like for breast cancer, for example, the Komen Foundation is one of the organizations in WINGS and others that are out there to help us with some of those costs.
That was Dr. Amelie Ramirez, Director for Cancer Prevention and Population Science at the Mays Cancer Center at UT Health San Antonio. When we come back, 50 years ago, students in a San Antonio high school walked out in protest.
And we just felt that maybe we're doing something that the rest of the students will benefit from. It may not be us, it may not be in our time, but it could happen that every school would have the same kind of facility, every child, no matter what your zip code was.
That's still to come on Fronteras. Stay with us. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. A report out by the Southern Poverty Law Center finds American students don't fully understand many facts about slavery and the role it played in U.S. history. As KERA's Stella Chavez reports, the study also says educators are not adequately teaching students about slavery.
The report surveyed high school seniors and social studies teachers. It also looked at state curriculum standards and some of the more commonly used U.S. history textbooks. Among the findings, only 8% of high school seniors could say slavery was the main cause of the Civil War. Nearly 70% didn't know a constitutional amendment formally ended slavery. And fewer than 1 in 4 students could explain how provisions in the Constitution supported slavery. Maureen Costello is director of teaching tolerance at the Southern Poverty Law Center and a former history teacher. One big problem, she says, is how slavery is taught.
It's taught with like a lot of mixed messages, starting in kindergarten. So kindergarten and first grade, kids learn about Sojourner Truth or they learn about Harriet Tubman. So great, Harriet Tubman, you know, led slaves out to freedom, but what is slavery? Well, we don't talk about that until fourth or fifth grade.
The report by the Southern Poverty Law Center gave low grades to a Texas textbook, saying it gives, quote, lip service to slavery. In 2015, the publisher of a Texas social studies textbook promised to make changes after a Houston family noticed the book identified African slaves as workers. Costello says across the country, slavery isn't covered thoroughly until high school. But by then, most kids know more about what she calls the good stories, stories like how abolitionists helped slaves. The other issue, she says, is that slavery is often taught as a problem in the South. Students don't understand the complexity of slavery and how it affected the North.
We don't really talk about how it was a source of profit and power, and we don't connect it to the present very well. And we also don't talk about how racism grew up to defend slavery. and how many of the racist ideas that were developed by slaveholders are still in the American mind today.
For the past year, Teaching Tolerance has been working with educators to help them teach American slavery. They've come up with some recommendations, like using historical documents and making sure textbooks include the lasting effects of racial oppression in the U.S.
Educators, 90% of them say they think it's important, they want to teach it, but often they don't know what to teach or how to teach it.
Costello says school districts can help by offering more training for teachers to teach slavery. I'm Stella Chavez in Dallas.
On October 2, 1989, the Texas Supreme Court ruled unanimously that the state's school finance system was unequal. The case was Edgewood ISD versus Kirby, pitting San Antonio's Edgewood Independent School District against the state education commissioner at the time, William Kirby. The district argued that since public schools were primarily financed through local property taxes, poorer districts like Edgewood could never raise the kind of money its richer counterparts could. That meant less cash for teacher salaries, supplies, and campus improvements. It was a question of fairness that had been in the courts for decades before the ruling. Its roots reach back 50 years ago to a student demonstration at Edgewood High School. This package was produced by the Texas Standard's Michael Marks.
We knew that, you know, we were smart, but at the same time, if we ever competed in like UIL contest, when we would go to the other schools for our competitions, we saw what they had. We saw the facilities. We saw their libraries. And we knew that none of that was available to us at Edgewood. My name is Rebecca Peña Ortiz, and I graduated from Edgewood High School in 1970. At Edgewood, we've always had a history of people coming and going, coming and going. They get their experience 1-2 years, and they're great teachers, and then they're off, and they go to a more lucrative district.
They were frustrated because they wanted to learn more, and they felt that they were missing out on the opportunity. My name is Roger Lloyd, and I graduated June the 2nd of 1969 from Edgewood High. I believe many of them didn't go to college because they felt, you know, insecure. They felt inferior. I know I did.
We had no air conditioning in that school. All the guys carried handkerchiefs. You put them around your neck so you wouldn't sweat your collar, because we didn't have a big, large wardrobe. We're gonna have to use that shirt again. My name is Richard Herrera, and I graduated the year 1969 from Edgewood High School. 3 weeks, maybe a month before, people start going, "Hey, man, this is going to be a walkout. This is going to be a walkout." We're going like, "What are you talking about?"
The leading up was all the discussion. Are you going to do it? Are you going to do it? Are you going? Are you going? Oh, no, I can't. No, I was told not to.
I'm Diana Herrera, and I graduated from Edgewood High School here in San Antonio, Texas in 1969. All the athletes were pulled in and were told, "You will not have a place on the team next year if you walk out." The seniors were told, "You will not cross the stage. You will not get a diploma. You will not graduate."
We knew what we were doing, and we knew that there might be a price to pay, both in school and at home.
So we find out what time, you know, May 16th, 9:20.
I remember the day because I felt kind of uneasy. Something was going on, but I couldn't put my finger on it.
The teachers try to stop us. Oh, you're not coming through this door. You're nobody leaves. So my teacher stands at the door, Ms. Mooney. Never forget it. If you're looking, you're not leaving. And I have a brother, he's a lower classman, comes to the door and looks to the door and says, "Come on, let's just go." And Ms. Mooney's in the way. So what he does, he starts pushing the door, and he eventually moves her out of the way. And we just all float out. Well over 400 kids.
And I know we marched all the way to the main office, and we yelled for Mr. Steinhauser, who was the superintendent then, to come out and address us and look at our concerns.
And then a spokesperson comes out and says, "Mr. Steinhauser's in here." So we look at each other, now what?
And we just felt that maybe we're doing something that the rest of the students will benefit from. It may not be us, it may not be in our time, but it could happen that every school would have the same kind of facility. Every child, no matter what your zip code was, would have the same kind of facility and learning environment in the state of Texas. And of course, I know that's still not true to this day.
I felt in my heart that the school system, the decision makers, were going to do everything possible for the goodness of an education of a child. And it hit me in the face when I started teaching in Edgewood in 74. And Richard and I are buying chalk and are buying little fans so I could have air, you know, oscillate in the classroom. You know, crayons, paper.
Everybody knows that it's not right. Everybody knows that it's not fair. Everybody knows that the system is not equal. So why don't they quit talking about it and just fix it?
Those were the voices of former students of Edgewood High School in San Antonio. Their walkout in May 1968 ultimately led to the decision that the state school finance system was unequal. This piece was produced by the Texas Standard's Michael Marks. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Norma Martinez and Jerry Quijano produced the broadcast. Our executive producers are Steve Short and Fernando Ortiz. Our digital editor is Vince Kong. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.